You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the recycling market took a hit in recent years with low prices of some materials, but it's bounced back, giving a boost to local programs. We'll find out what it all means for recycling in your community. Now, researchers with Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the National Park Service, and the University of Minnesota found a cluster of endangered mollusks they believe to be over 100 years old. These spectacle-case mussels live in the St. Croix River, which forms part of the border between Wisconsin and Minnesota and feeds into the Mississippi. We're learning more about the rare species and the role it plays in the ecosystem. Lisi Kitchell is a conservation biologist for the Wisconsin DNR. Lisi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you bet.
Well, introduce us first to this mussel, please. Could you describe it and tell us why it's so rare?
Well, the spectacle case is called that because when the old pearl button clammers named them back in the 1800s, they thought that the shape of the shell reminded them of that case that you'd put your spectacles in back then. When it's full grown, it's 8 to 9 inches long, and it's kind of shaped a little like an eyeglass case that you might find today, which are called clamshell cases. But so that's why it got named as such. They tend to be a mussel that has always been rare in the sense that they're found in a habitat that's not commonly searched for mussels. And in recent years, they have significantly declined to about half their range. And even in the range where they do occur, they're not that common. So it's a rare species. It's both state and federally listed. And it was nice to find this population above the St. Croix Falls Dam.
How do you spot a rare mussel species in a river? What do you do to go out and find these guys?
Well, normally you'd go out and you'd grub along the bottom looking for the mussels that are there. And fortunately for this species, it tends not to be out in the main river in the bottom of the main river like the rest of the mussels are. It tends to occur in these what I call hidey holes in rock piles. So these are not rocks, small rocks. These are big boulders and big slabs of rock that are have areas where the rock is piled up, and then there's crevices in between those rocks, and that's where these guys hide. And you really can't see them from outside, so you actually have to reach in and try to find them in there. Sometimes they're under the edges of really big boulders, so you might be able to see those, but you really have to go looking for them. They're not as obvious as the mussels that occur in the majority of the river.
You mentioned in the St. Croix River, this find was north of the dam there, a key dam. And that's an important part of the story as to why they're endangered, especially in a place like this. Why does the dam affect their life cycle?
Well, these guys were, the fact that they were still alive was pretty surprising. They were well over 100 years old because an important link for our native freshwater mussels is that they have to actually have a fish host to complete their life cycle. And not all mussels will use all fish. These guys tend to use the moon eye and the gold eye. And those fish were blocked from getting to that upper part of the St. Croix River once the dam, St. Croix Falls Dam, was built in 1907. So that's a very migratory, those fish are highly migratory species. So they would, before the dam was built, they would get up through the Cascading Falls and go further upstream. Once the dam was built, they could no longer get upstream. So the important piece with these guys was that the population downstream of the dam still has gold eye and moon eye present and can reproduce and complete their life cycles. But the ones above the dam could no longer reproduce. I mean, they could go ahead and make sperm and eggs, but they, without having the fish host to complete their life cycle, they couldn't complete their reproduction.
How can you tell if a mussel is over 100 years old?
Well, the way you age mussels is not unlike the way you age trees, in that they put down an annuli every year. They go down in the substrate in the winter, and then when they come back up in the spring, then there's a margin, that shell margin is darkened, and then the new growth is lighter. So you can actually look at those rings, just like trees, But the problem with these guys were two things. One, when they're that old, the growth rings are right next to each other, so they're very hard to distinguish. But more importantly, the shells were eroded, again, because they were so old. And so you really couldn't see those external rings. So what we did was we saved some of the dead shells that we found along with alive individuals, and we will cross-section through those shells and then be able to actually count the annuli by seeing those without the erosion on the outside of the shell. And so we estimated their age just based on the fact that even if these guys were born the day the dam was built, they had to be at least 114 years old, and they're more than likely 120, possibly 130 years old.
Talking to Lisa Kitchell from the Wisconsin DNR about a rare species of mussel in Wisconsin rivers. These spectacle case mussels, what role do they play in a river ecosystem?
Well, they, along with all the other mussels that live in the river, are truly aquatic engineers. They are our water filter systems. Each individual mussel can filter 10 gallons or more a day, and you have mussel beds with hundreds and sometimes thousands of mussels in them. So they're really filtering our water. They're taking out contaminants. They're taking out some of the sediment that's there. So they're really significant contributors to the water quality. In the St. Croix, you have good water quality, but these guys are ensuring that water quality continues. So that's their primary ecological contribution, although they do take things that are in the water column, they concentrate that down and then they excrete that. So the other things that live on the bottom, like the bugs and the crayfish, they make that food available to them as well, which wouldn't be available from the water column.
As we wrap up, what are the DNR and partners doing to try to protect, maybe even grow back the mussel population?
Right. Well, we are propagating spectacle case at the Genoa National Fish Hatchery and at the Minnesota Propagation Facility. However, without the fish host above the dam, it's not worth putting mussels up there if they can't complete their life cycle. Below the dam, there are fairly good population of spectacle case, and we're actually propagating them so we can put them out in rivers where we've lost that species, but we still have the fish host. So the ones above the dam, unfortunately, unless we can get the fish hosts up there, which is unlikely, the prospect for them does not look good.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Lisa Kitchell is a conservation biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She was with us today to share the discovery of 100-plus-year-old mussels in the St. Croix River. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story from 2020 about someone bringing a community together by building boats.
Birch bark canoes take a long time to make, but master artist Wayne Vallier from the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, tells us that the process is just as important as the finished project. And he should know. Vallier was just selected to be a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment of the Arts, one of the top honors in folk and traditional art. Mackenzie Martin with WXPR in Rhinelander brings us the story. It's part of their Curious North series.
In early August, master artist Wayne Vallier started working with apprentices in Lac du Flambeau to build a birch bark canoe.
Hello, we're back. We're still in Wayne's garage.
Throughout the canoe's construction, the process was live streamed on the Waswaganing Indian Bull Facebook page.
And they're working on the ribs to go on the inside of the canoe, so let me turn this around.
The project was part of a larger grant from the First Nations Development Institute.
Wayne Vallier, master canoe builder, teaching us how to do this.
All right, let's push another one, right here.
My name is Wayne Vallier. My native name is Good Sky. As far as Ojibwe canoe builders, there are only five master builders left in the Midwest.
And two of the five master Ojibwe canoe builders left happen to be in Lac du Flambeau. It's Wayne and his brother Leon.
Pushing this down here.
Wayne Vallier has now made over 30 canoes in different communities, and he thinks something that's really important about this work is the way it's able to connect people from different areas.
That connection of the high-end canoe is one that the Anishinaabe brought from the eastern seaboard. It connects the Ottawas, the Potawatomis, and the Ojibways together.
What does it mean to still be doing this work and to not only be doing this work, but to be training a younger generation on how to do this?
It makes me feel close to my ancestors. It's a responsibility of the older artists of my age to do this for the next generation so that our culture lives on. By knowing where you've been, you'll have a better understanding and where you're going.
Valier believes that the more people they include in the building of the canoe, the more experiences they have represented in the canoe.
We tried to have as many different hands touching these canoes as possible. What happens is people imprint part of their life essence in these canoes. They put a few stitches in. That few stitches stays there for a long time. It becomes very powerful. So at the end of all of that, all the sweat and the life that's happening around these canoes, something very beautiful comes out of it.
He says you can think of the entire process as a reminder of the benefits of teamwork. Like, by itself, the birch bark is weak, the spruce root that ties the whole thing together is fragile, and the pitch that seals the canoe is easily manipulated.
But when you put all of these things together and they work in sync, the canoe becomes very strong, so strong that a person could take a hammer and beat on the side of one of these canoes and you're not going to pierce a hole in it. The teaching is when we stand alone, we are weak, but when we stand together, we're very strong.
Another takeaway, creating something strong takes time.
WXPR's Mackenzie Martin brought us that story as part of their Curious North series. It's a lot like WPR's Wisconsin Project, where we answer audience questions in Wisconsin Life segments. To submit your question, go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, prices for recyclable goods have been way up lately. That means more funding for recycling centers around Wisconsin. We'll learn more about how this all works from the state's Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. According to the Wisconsin DNR, just 2 years ago, there was a crisis in recycling. Less demand for recycled materials meant challenging times for facilities that process recyclables from consumers. Now the situation has turned around. The department last month reported record high values for recycled materials. Jennifer Semrau is the Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR's Waste and Materials Management Program. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is happening with recycled good prices right now?
Yeah, well, as we mentioned in our press release, we're really happy to report that pricing is up. And as you noted, that has not always been the case. We did have a couple of years where pricing for recyclable commodities was rather depressed, but we've seen an increase in demand over this past year, and that's been reflected in increased pricing.
Let's look at the why behind both parts of this story. Let's go back a couple years to, say, 2019. You know, we heard China wasn't going to take some kinds of recycled material anymore. What was going on that was driving down these prices and creating trouble for recycling facilities?
Sure. Yeah, you really hit it on the head that some of the markets that the United States used to rely upon, like China and other Southeast Asian countries, started closing their doors to recyclables from the United States. And the reason that they did that is because we weren't sending them high quality recyclables. There was too much trash and non-recyclable materials in those loads that were going overseas. And so they just really became much more strict on what they would accept and set higher contamination limits. I should say lower contamination limits. But as a result of that, it told the United States, well, we need to improve our domestic marketplace. And so that's somewhat what has happened over the past couple of years since.
I was wondering about that. Is this spike, we had this record about a month ago in a lot of key prices, is it because of a long-term improvement in demand, or is there some sort of like COVID-related spike going on here?
It really is both. I mean, on the plastic sides, we see a lot of COVID impact, if you will. There's a lot of single-use items that have become more prevalent with COVID. And so that's where we're seeing a bit of the plastic increasing. And I guess also you could say on the fiber side as well, because so many of us are having items shipped to our home. We used to shop in person much more, and now instead we're having items shipped to our homes, and that's been increasing the demand for cardboard.
Talking to Jennifer Semrau, Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR's Waste and Materials Management Program, talking about an upswing in just the last 2 years in the prices of recycled products, helping local facilities. Okay, so what does this jump in prices, Jennifer, mean for, you know, municipalities, counties, local governments who run recycling programs?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for some programs, this has enabled them to take on some capital projects that they've had to put on hold. I've spoken to some facility operators across the state that have been able to add some equipment, things that like an eddy current that helps separate aluminum, adding additional optical sorters and robotics. So really trying to improve their facilities, taking advantage of these extra commodity values. And others, you know, frankly, you know, ran a deficit and are now able to add back into that, you know, rainy day fund to ensure that when markets dip, which they do, markets do go up and down, that they'll have those funds that they need for future operations.
Big picture, how much material gets diverted into recycling in Wisconsin, meaning it doesn't end up in a landfill instead?
Sure, you bet. Our latest figures are from 2020, you know, last year, and that year we recycled 750,000 tons of materials. And I do want to point out that that's really just from residential and some commercial entities. We don't actually collect data on all of the recycling activity that happens in the state. So for instance, there is some commercial recycling that may go directly to a paper mill because we have such a strong paper industry in Wisconsin. So we only collect data from those recycling processors. We call them material recovery facilities, and they're the ones who report to us. So even just with that subset of the recycling activity, 750,000 tons last year.
I know from one community to another, there's a lot of variation in what you can and can't recycle. Do you see trends, Jennifer, in more communities being able to take and use particular types of material or getting away from particular materials?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you are correct. It does vary across the state on what you can or cannot recycle. But that being said, there is a universal list of items that can be recycled everywhere. So cardboard boxes, milk jugs, aluminum cans, steel cans, glass bottles, and paper can be recycled everywhere in the state. Where it does get a bit more tricky is in other types of plastic materials. So when you get away from, say, soda bottles, milk bottles, and detergent bottles, then, you know, it really does vary across the state. To answer your question, yeah, we are seeing an increase, though, in programs that can accept some additional plastics, such as dairy containers and like deli containers.
Is there some good general advice you have for, you know, us people in how we recycle to make things easier in our local facility and make sure it ends up saving money for the local government?
Sure. I guess one piece of advice is not to wish cycle. That is actually a term that we use in the industry, where when a person isn't sure if something's recyclable, but you just really hope it is. So you're wishing for it to be so and putting it in your recycling container. Checking locally is just the best advice I can give. Every local government in Wisconsin is required to do some recycling education. So they should know, you know, what you can recycle at your local program. And so just checking, if you're not sure on a particular item, instead of guessing, you know, one way or the other, is really the best way to go.
Speaking of wishes, a lot of people making their wish lists for holiday shopping right now. Any thoughts to share with us on recycling for all the materials that come along with a holiday like Christmas?
Yeah, you bet. Again, as I mentioned, cardboard can be recycled everywhere across the state of Wisconsin. So all of those boxes that you may have gotten your holiday presents in, break them down. They take up a lot less space in your cart as well as in the recycling truck if you can break down those boxes. And again, you can recycle those anywhere in the state. But other things like wrapping paper, that's going to be one of those examples that you need to check locally. Some programs will take wrapping paper that doesn't have any glitter or foil, things like that. But others can't take it at all depending on their facility operations. So one other piece of advice, keep the bows and the ribbons out. Nowhere in Wisconsin are those recyclable, so save them for next year.
Now, when we wave bye to our recycling carts, are we going to see this stuff again? Do these recycled products end up in goods that we end up using down the road?
Absolutely. I mentioned our paper industry, and so that's just really a great example. The vast majority of paper that's recycled by residents in Wisconsin stays in Wisconsin and goes to Wisconsin paper mills. So depending on what type of mill it is, you know, for instance, a tissue mill that makes napkins, toilet paper, paper towels, things of that nature, you truly couldn't be using something that you recycled in the past in a product that you're buying today.
What are you watching for just in our last few moments, Jennifer, with future trends? We saw a low to a high when it came to these prices. What are you watching for now?
Sure. I mean, it's natural to expect that we'll see a slight decline. Again, over time, recycling markets are a wave up and down over time. So I do expect prices to dip a little bit, but I also do not expect us to go down to the values that we saw a couple of years ago where, you know, certain commodities were not worth you know, much more than $0 a ton. So I think we can expect some positive markets going into 2022.
Jennifer, thanks again for joining us.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Semrau is the DNR Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator. We talked to her about the low and then the high in values of recycled materials. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get a bonus edition of the WPR podcast mapped out, looking at the past and future of our political boundaries. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then raising the debt ceiling and passing a big social safety net and climate change package. Those are just two of the things Democrats in Congress are trying to get done before the end of the year. We'll find out what's moving forward, what's stuck, and more in our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we get the latest COVID news, including increased hospitalizations here in Wisconsin. First, Congress has a busy end-of-year to-do list, and there appears to be some progress on a few key items. Congressional leaders say they've agreed on a way to raise the debt ceiling, and an important defense spending bill passed the House last night. There's still uncertainty, though, on Democrats' top priority, a $2 trillion social safety net and climate change package. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about those stories and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad to see this apparent compromise on raising the debt ceiling and how it's done? Do you think Republicans should have held out to make it more difficult and put it more on Democrats to raise the limit on their own? Have you been watching this Defense Authorization Act? Are you glad to see members of Congress from both parties come together on an item like this? In general, do you want to see more compromise between the parties on key issues facing Congress? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tolu Olorunipa is a political investigations and enterprise reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, I want to start out with a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi talking about the deal to raise the debt ceiling I just mentioned. Here she is at a press conference earlier today.
The legislation we passed provided a process under which we could pass, lift the debt ceiling with a simple majority rather than 60 votes in the Senate.
All right. We keep having these debt ceiling deadlines coming up. Tolu, what is changing here and how Congress can increase this thing?
Well, one thing that is changing is that there is more pressure being put on Republicans to not essentially vote for an increase to the debt ceiling because, among others, former President Donald Trump has said that that is a negotiating chip that they should not give in so easily to the Democrats, especially since Democrats want to use the additional cushion in from the debt ceiling to push forward with a pretty expansive social spending program. So there is a little bit more pressure, but it seems like the alternative of allowing the United States to default on its debt is a bridge too far for a number of leading Republicans. So they're coming up with some kind of workaround where they will be able to allow Democrats only to vote for this measure to increase the debt ceiling, but they won't essentially stand in the way. So it's something that we go through every few months because there are these major ideological differences between the two parties about debt and deficits and how much money the government should be spending. And it always seems to take us right to the brink of a disaster. But at least for the past several years, we haven't gone over that cliff. We got pretty close to it almost a decade ago, but we didn't go over, and we suffered the downgrading of our credit as a nation. That was the closest that we've gotten to sort of the siren that would be a default. But every few months, we still get close and tiptoe to the edge. And it seems like we're getting closer and closer, in part because there's so much political pressure among Republicans not to allow Democrats to move forward with their social spending agenda.
So this is a little wonky, Tulu. I want to make sure I have this right. Some Republicans in the Senate voted not directly to raise the debt ceiling, but to say, we're giving you enough votes now so that you can vote to raise the debt ceiling without us later. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's essentially right. It's a multi-step process, in part because of these political considerations that Republicans have. So they're essentially saying, we're not voting for the debt to increase. We're basically just allowing Democrats to vote for it. And one part of this measure is that when Democrats do eventually vote for this increase, they're going to have their names linked to a number, a specific number that's likely going to be above $30 trillion, where the national debt is. Some Republicans are going to use that number against Democrats, especially against moderate Democrats, saying, look at how these Democrats are spending all of this money, raising your taxes and driving your descendants and your children deeper into national debt. Look at how they voted. Look at how many times they voted to raise the debt ceiling. So it really has become kind of this political game, even though it's a very serious subject. And it would be calamitous for the nation to default on its debt. There'd be all kinds of, waves and aftershocks that would impact the economy and cause people to lose jobs and impact people's retirement funds and all of those things. But right now, it seems like there's a bigger political debate taking place far removed from those consequences.
Talking to Tulu Olorunipa from the Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, focusing on Congress right now and some bills being passed. Jimmy is with us now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hello, gentlemen. Yeah, I just had a comment. The defense authorization bill just authorized, I think it was $768 billion for 1 year for the Department of Defense. And, of course, with the Build Back Better and the infrastructure bill, that was over 10 years, and it was only, I think, the infrastructure was 1.2, and maybe the Build Back Better is about $2 trillion. But there wasn't a peep in the media about the size of the defense budget, and that's just 1 year. And I just think it shows you that what gets focused on and what doesn't. And I'll take my comments off there.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Tulu, Jimmy, talking about that National Defense Authorization Act, 768, I think is the right price tag. I don't have it in front of me right now. Can you tell us a little bit about that bill, first of all, before we compare it to the spending packages?
Yeah, this is another annual thing that Congress has to do. In addition to raising the debt ceiling every once in a while, every year they have to pass a defense spending bill to talk about and describe where the Pentagon, where the Defense Department is going to be spending the hundreds of billions of dollars it gets to essentially to keep the country safe, to fight the various conflicts that the United States is in, to station troops overseas, to protect the homeland. And the caller does make a good point, because sometimes it's very easy for those very large numbers to get glossed over just because it's something that we do as a country every year. We are far and away the largest in the world when it comes to defense spending. We spend more than any other country and several other of our competitor countries combined. But it is something that has become kind of an autopilot thing, for lack of a better word, both in the media and just in the public consciousness, because we do spend hundreds of billions of dollars every year to essentially keep the country safe and to keep other countries safe and to do all of the things that are done that, you know, that the Pentagon does. And, you know, sometimes there is a question about whether some of that money gets wasted, whether it could be better spent in other places, and how it compares to what we do in terms of spending for education or spending for childcare or spending for social programs. And the caller does make a very good point that there are a growing number of people, especially among the progressives in the in the Democrat Party, that are saying, you know, it's time to maybe scale back some of that defense spending and see if we can put some of that money to better use elsewhere. Do we really need this many fighter jets? Do we really need to have so many people stationed all over the world? Do we need to be involved in so many conflicts? And that is a question that I think is going to creep up more and more, especially as there are growing questions about debt and deficit, even among some moderate Democrats. And that's one of the reasons President Joe Biden has had some trouble getting his social spending plan through, because there are some Democrats that aren't in favor of spending that much money right now. They're trying to figure out how to get those Democrats, especially, you know, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, on board so that they can move this agenda forward.
Let's bring out another caller now at 800-642-1234. Denny is with us in Waupaca. Denny, hi.
Yes, hi. I'm a data guy, and I voted for a number of Republican presidents. But you can look it up, and 60% of our American debt was created on a Republican's watch, and 75% of it because of a Republican's watch. Our last president created $3.8 trillion in debt before COVID. So when I hear this talk, and I voted for more Republicans than Democrats, okay, that's not my point. When I hear the point, I think the Democrats do a horrible job of explaining where debt came from and who really created it. I'd like to just some comments on that from your guest.
Denny, thanks for the call. Tolu, the blame game on debt.
Well, that is a blame game that we can expect to continue to happen for quite a while. The caller is right. And, you know, especially when we talk about the last president, former President Trump did add to the national deficit. He did cut taxes. He did continue to increase spending. There was not very much done to tackle any of the issues related to deficits and debt. They just continued to go up, even when the economy was growing, and especially when COVID hit and the economy stopped growing, and we were spending a lot more money because we had a pandemic going on and so many people out of work. You know, the debt just increased, you know, exponentially. And there have been a large number of Republicans who have increased the debt while they're in office. And then, you know, when they get out of power, there's all of this focus on, you know, we're spending too much, the debt is too much. Now, obviously, Republicans have different ideas than Democrats about, you know, where we should be spending money. And maybe if we're, you know, increasing the deficit because we're cutting taxes, that's a better thing in their mind than if we're increasing the deficit because we're spending and creating new social programs. But at the end of the day, we have seen both parties increase the debt over the past several decades. It has increased more under Republicans in recent presidencies. And that's something that, you know, doesn't always get talked about, in part because Republicans have done a good job of messaging when it comes to, you know, talking about the deficits and the debt when they're out of power and really making it harder for Democratic presidents and Congresses to move forward with the kinds of social spending they want to do, because there's this question about, are we increasing the size of government too much? Are we spending too much money? Is the debt going up too much? And it's something that we don't hear as much about when Republicans are trying to cut taxes, in part because they can tell people, we're cutting your taxes, we're letting you keep more of your money, and you can decide what to do with it, even though the deficits and the debt continue to go up when that happens.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Tolu Olorunipa, political investigations and enterprise reporter at The Washington Post. With us today for our weekly roundup of some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up, the January 6th committee, who is testifying, who is not. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more Trump administration officials cooperate with House investigators? Some trials related to that coming up, I believe, next summer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Tolu Olorunipa is with us from the Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. On the table now, the January 6th committee investigations. And coming up, a look at conflict, accusation of anti-Muslim bias among members of Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tulu, the January 6th Investigation Committee in the House. We've got Mark Meadows now, former chief of staff for President Trump. At one point said he would come in for a deposition, shared some information. Now he's back out. What's going on?
Well, it seems like he realized for his own political future, especially after he just came out with a major book that the former president was not happy with, that if he was seen cooperating with the January 6th committee that former President Trump very much dislikes, that he might be a persona non grata among Republicans going forward. He, you know, in his own words, he said that, you know, he started and wanted to cooperate with the committee, but he saw that they were not respecting executive privilege, so he decided to pull back. But it's pretty clear that, you know, at the moment he had been in the doghouse with the former president, who was his boss, and he decided to pull back and not engage with the Democrats. Now, he's not doing this without risk. Democrats have already called for charges to be filed, contempt charges to be filed against previous individuals who defied their subpoenas and defied their calls for them to come testify and answer questions as part of this committee's work. So he could potentially find himself, you know, under that kind of prosecution, because Congress does have some power to try to compel testimony. So it is a kind of a tricky situation that he finds himself in, but it seems like the tide is turning in some ways against this committee, as a growing number of people who said that they were going to cooperate or who indicated they were going to cooperate are really turning away and deciding to defy their authority and essentially say that, you know, well, we'll see you in court. So this could be a battle that ends up playing out for several months, if not years. And that's not what this committee wants. They wanted to wrap up this work long before the midterms take place. And the court battles could just end up dragging this thing out for quite a while, maybe even until past the midterms, where Democrats could lose control of Congress and the entire investigation could be shut down.
There are reports that people on former Vice President Mike Pence's team, including Mark Short, a chief of staff with him on January 6th, that he was hiding out from people chanting "Hang Mike Pence" in the Capitol building, are cooperating. What are we hearing there, and why might they have something to offer?
Well, we do know that, especially people who worked for Mike Pence, that you know, they're not in the best, they don't all have the best opinion of former President Trump right now, because not only did, you know, Trump not call off the mob and the rioters when his own vice president was in danger and people were shouting, "Hang Mike Pence," but even since, you know, he was asked by Jonathan Carl of ABC News for a book that came out recently, whether or not, you know, he thought that went too far, that the "Hang Mike Pence" chants, or whether he thought his vice president was in danger. And he essentially said, you know, he understood the people who were chanting that. He understood why people were angry, and he still believed that Mike Pence did the wrong thing by, you know, essentially allowing the certification of the election to go forward. So I wouldn't be surprised if we do see some people who worked for Mike Pence willing to cooperate with this committee, in part because they may feel less fealty to the former president, because he's shown very little loyalty to his vice president in the aftermath of January 6th.
Talking to Tulu Olorunipa from The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Let's move on now. This is a strange dispute. A Colorado member of Congress, Lauren Boebert, caught on tape and elsewhere making anti-Muslim remarks about some of her House colleagues. I want to give a listen to Representative Ayanna Pressley behind an effort to strip Representative Boebert of her committee assignments in response. Here she is at a press conference. This was earlier today.
For a member of Congress to repeatedly and unapologetically use hateful, racist, and Islamophobic tropes towards a Muslim colleague is dangerous. This sort of toxic behavior has no place in the halls of Congress, and it diminishes the honor of the institution that we all serve in.
Can you remind us of some of the backstory on this dispute, Tulu?
Well, we did see a video of Congresswoman Boebert using some anti-Semitic language back during a town hall or an event back in her district, where she essentially, you know, made up a story saying that she ran into Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the couple of Muslim congresswomen in Congress. And, you know, she said that she was afraid essentially that Congresswoman Omar might have, you know, been plotting some kind of terrorist attack on the Congress. Now, she did it in a joking manner, but these are the kinds of things that, you know, really have been condemned not only by Democrats, but also by some Republicans as not only Islamophobic, but also, you know, just cruel and mean and not in keeping with the tradition of, you know, geniality in Congress. At once, you know, there it once was a place where, you know, people could work across the aisle and there wasn't this kind of nastiness taking place. And now there's, it seems like Democrats are looking to once again strip committee assignments from a Republican member of Congress. It's been something that had not been done in the past. You know, parties used to rely on one another to discipline their own people, but that hasn't been happening. And now, you know, Democrats are in power. They've used that power to strip a couple of other members of the Republican Party from their assignments because of their incendiary rhetoric. And Republicans are already saying that, you know, if we get back in power, especially if we win during the midterms, we're going to come back and we're going to use this power to strip some Democrats from their assignments because we don't like the things that they have said or we don't like how they've conducted themselves outside of the halls of Congress. So it is a very nasty and acrimonious situation. And it does appear that it's only getting worse.
Is there a consensus among Democrats so far, especially, I guess, among House leaders among Democrats who would have to move this forward to strip a member of Congress of committee assignments?
There has not been much pushback, at least publicly, and the progressive wing is really taking a run at this, essentially saying that, you know, Democrats need to stick together. They're a diverse party. They need to make sure that even the members of the party that aren't part of a large constituency, you know, members who may be part of a minority group, have the backing of the rest of their party. So we haven't seen a lot of pushback from leaders. It's a very delicate situation because, you know, the leadership of the Democratic Party does not want to air some of its divisions within its caucus at a time like this, where they would rather be seen, you know, unifying against Islamophobia, unifying around and supporting, you know, one of their members, someone who gets a lot of death threats and is the victim of a lot of attacks from the public. And so for that reason, even if there is some angst about, you know, moving forward to strip yet another member of Congress from his or her committee assignments over something they said outside of Congress, it's not being heard. You're not hearing a lot of pushback from Democratic leaders. And we'll see where this goes. Maybe it fades, maybe it's not something that they end up doing, but there does seem to be some fire on the side of the progressives to try to push forward and get something done and make sure that there are consequences for this kind of rhetoric.
And on the Republican side, there was a flare-up between a Republican colleague and and Boebert and others involved in this last week. Are we seeing much from Republican House leadership to try to rein things in here?
We're not seeing much, and I think in part it's because they are looking at 2022. They also want to be seen as unified. They don't want to air some of the divisions within their party, even though those divisions are starting to, you know, air themselves. A lot of Republican leaders, especially Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader in the House, is just trying to go along to get along, just trying to keep everyone on board long enough to potentially win back the House and get the Speaker's gavel. Those are two different things. If Republicans win back the House, it's not a given that Kevin McCarthy would be the leader, and he needs to keep his caucus together. He needs to keep his caucus behind him. That's why you've seen him very reluctant to discipline or to speak negatively about some of his more outspoken members of Congress, because he does not necessarily want to lose their votes, because if he does, he could end up not being the Speaker of the House if they win back the majority. He could find himself on the outs, which would be an embarrassing end to his political career.
Tolu, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You got it. Thank you.
That's Tolu Olorunipa, political investigations and enterprise reporter at The Washington Post. He was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in the nation's capital. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin hospitals are strained as COVID infections go up around the state. We'll find out how hospitals are responding and then check in with a Wisconsin infection expert about the latest news about COVID-19 and the new variant. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.